Good morning, and welcome to Kerygma and to our exploration of the Book of Revelation. We have now come to chapter 12, and today we'll be dealing with the woman and the dragon in particular. Here's where we left off last week, with the climactic statement and with a major transition in the Book of Revelation. We left off at the end of chapter 11, verses 15 through 19. When the seventh angel blew his trumpet, there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord, for you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nations raged, but your wrath has come. And the time has come for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants, and for destroying those who destroy the earth." What John has just announced to us is what happened back in chapter 8 when the seventh seal was finally cracked, and we were led to believe that the final climactic revelation would happen and we would know what God's future is. But only to find out that there was silence in heaven for half an hour. And then the deck was reshuffled, and we moved from the seven seals to the seven trumpets. And then as the seventh trumpet is blown, of course, we're now told what has happened. John has taken 11 chapters, nearly one half the book of Revelation, as an introduction, just to set the stage for what now follows. The seals have been opened. The trumpets have been blown. The message has finally been revealed. The kingdom of this world has become, past tense, the kingdom of God. Now, of course, this is not a literal or a factual statement, because John's people, his audience, would know that outwardly, nothing has changed with these words. Rome is still in power. God's people are still being persecuted. People of faith are still dying. This is what's called a prophetic statement. We see it very often in the book, in the prophets. Here, the prophetic statement is simply that God lays claim to the world, even though it's something maybe that we can't fully see yet. The premise is simple. If God says it, you can put it in the bank, it will happen. And God has now said that God lays claim to our world. All that remains is the working out of this certainty in its details. And of course, that is what the remainder of the book of Revelation is about. In other words, now, here in chapter 12, it begins. Now we will begin to see the future that God has for John's world, for John's time, and for God's people. In the remainder of the book of Revelation, the book is going to address two key questions, and we're going to look two directions for that. First, we're going to deal with the past. We're going to look back in the past. And the question is simple. How did things get to be the way they are in the book of Revelation? How did evil come to be so strong, so powerful? The second, we're going to look to the future. And we're going to look to the future to answer that question that arises from the past. How will God fix the mess that the world is in? We are now going to be introduced to some strange characters, the woman, the dragon, and the two beasts. Today, we're going to simply deal with the woman and the dragon. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. A great portent, a great sign or symbol, not literal, portent, appeared in heaven. A woman. And now we're going to describe the woman symbolically. Clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet. She has cosmic significance. On her head, here's the key revelation, a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant. She was crying out in birth pangs, in the agony of giving birth. The key here is that the woman has a crown of 12 stars. This tells us who she is. Now, the number 12 carries great symbolic meaning, both within Judaism and within the Christian faith, which comes out of Judaism. In Judaism, 12 would represent or would remind people of the 12 tribes. Even though the 12 tribes have not existed for nearly 900 years, still, the 12 tribes is a symbolic representation of God's people, Israel. In Christianity, it would bring to mind the 12 apostles. So the 12 tribes become the 12 disciples, become the 12 apostles, and so 12 would represent the church as the new Israel. So the woman represents the people of God, Israel, and the people of Jesus. Either way, the woman is a symbol for God's people. We'll see that as the story unfolds. Now, at this point in time, John's writing in 9095 AD, into the first century, he's probably not making a firm distinction between Israel and the church. He's probably still thinking, as most people did, of Judaism and Christianity not being separate entities, but essentially being the same thing. Christians were a movement within Judaism, so the Jewish imagery and the Christian imagery can be swapped back and forth, as John does. For him, likely no distinction. They are the same. Now, the Apostle Paul had introduced this idea nearly 50 years earlier, so we want to just take a quick look at it. We see it in the letter of Romans chapter 9, where this is what he says. Not all Israelites truly belong to Israel. It is not the children of the flesh who are the children of God, but the children of promise are counted as descendants. They remember that Paul refers to the covenant with Abraham, covenant made with faith, not with blood. So God's people, Israel, made up of Jews, made up of Christians, people of faith. The other key insight that he gives us is that the woman is in fact pregnant. Something is being born, something is coming into the world, a male child. Now, if you're a Christian, this symbol is pretty straightforward. This is John's Christmas story. A male child being born from God's people. Now, in a few verses, John is going to make clear, even more clear, that this child is Jesus as he'll move from the story of the birth to the story of what happened to this child afterwards. But first, we're going to be introduced to a new character, the character of the dragon. Verses 3 and 4. Then another portent, another sign, another symbol, not literal, symbolic, appeared in heaven. A great red dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 crowns or diadems on their heads. Strange figure. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven, a third of the angels of heaven were swept out of heaven and threw them to the earth. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And again, for any Christian, there's no question as to what's being referred to here. But her child was snatched away, taken to God and to his throne. And again, if you're a Christian, clearly you understand what John's referring to. With the term portent, symbol, sign, John reminds us that all the imagery in Exodus, in the book of Revelation, is symbolic rather than literal. He'll talk about his vision. He returns this over. John constantly wants to remind us he's using one set of images to talk about something else. So don't get literal with the images. Understand what they apply to. Here, a son is born. He is at first snatched away, then taken to God and his throne. Born, taken away, goes to God. Symbolically, John has just outlined the entire gospel, the story of the life, the death, and the resurrection, or you might say the ascension of Jesus, his return to God. John now identifies the dragon with symbols that link it to a power that's here on earth, a power that anyone living in John's time would know. Seven heads, John says. John will later tell us that the seven heads are the seven hills. And for anybody living in John's time or living in our time, he'll tell us it's the great city. What great city is there that's built on seven hills? The ten horns, likely references to ten provinces that the Roman Empire is divided into. Seven diadems or crowns refers to seven Roman emperors. This gives us a dating for the book. Of course, the first emperor is Augustus. And if you then roll forward to seven emperors, where would that put you? Later, John's going to say there's an eighth emperor who's one of the seven, but also the eighth. Another clue. Again, John is going to give us more information later about these emperors. As we progress through the book of Revelation, it's going to become increasingly clear that the dragon, the cosmic power of evil, the Satan, the devil, is closely connected to the Roman Empire. And that's the Roman Empire who is, in fact, the beast. The statement that the dragon sought to devour his child, her child, as soon as it was born, could mean a couple of things. It could be a reference to Herod's slaughter of the children in Jerusalem. More likely, though, it's probably a reference to the crucifixion story, because the dragon is more connected to Rome than to Herod. Verse 4. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared for her by God, so that there she can be nourished for 1,260 days. Here's that number. We're going to see it again and again. We'll see it in days. We'll see it in months, 42 months. We'll see it in weeks. Here we see it in days. And we'll see it in years. On the one hand, this is Exodus imagery. Fleeing from the wilderness, nourished in the wilderness by God, would immediately bring to mind that the people of the Exodus story, God brings them out of Egypt, brings them into the wilderness. They're nourished, they're fed manna, they're fed quail, they're given water. God takes care of them. And so John's message is this. Just as Israel was nourished and trusted in God in the past, so too, we should trust God in our own suffering. This is to John's generation. Now, this number is going to be repeated again, even in this chapter. It's going to be a time, a half time, and two times. Well, 1,260 days, or 42 months, or a time, a half time, and two times are all the same, 3.5 years. This number is taken from the book of Daniel, but really goes back to a historic event of Jewish persecution from an earlier time under the Greek ruler Antiochus Epiphanes, who came in, conquered the Jews, desecrated the temple, put an abomination, an altar to another god there, and it was 3.5 years before the Jews were able to take the temple back and to cleanse it and return it to the worship of God. Here's what Daniel speaks of. He, Antiochus Epiphanes, shall speak words against the Most High, he'll blaspheme God, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, they shall be persecuted, and shall attempt to change the sacred seasons and the law. We know that Antiochus Epiphanes historically tried to do away with everything that gave the Jewish people their religious identity. He outlawed the Torah, circumcision, kosher, observing the Sabbath, anything that Jews could do. If they continued to do those things, they would suffer the consequences. And in Daniel we have, and they, God's people, shall be given into his power for a time, two times, and a half a time. Which, by the way, links exactly to historically the 3.5 years that the temple was under his control. 167 BCE, this was literal, the length of persecution by the Greeks. But in later Jewish tradition, it began to have a more symbolic meaning. A time, two times, and a half a time, 3.5 years, began to represent any period of persecution and suffering that God's people went through. In other words, it wasn't forever, but it wasn't going away quickly. Strikingly, John sees this time of persecution, this time of suffering, as a time of nourishment. Again, drawing on the Exodus imagery. Just as Israel was shaped by her time in the wilderness, those living in John's time are now going to be shaped by the period of persecution that they're experiencing. John now gives us the backstory to how things became the way they are. The story begins in heaven. Verse 7. War broke out in heaven. Civil war. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels, civil war in heaven, fought back. But they were defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. The great dragon was cast down. That ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down, repeating this over and over, to the earth. And his angels were thrown down with him. Now, Satan thrown down from heaven. John is drawing again on Jewish imagery, a tradition of the day. John gives us just a little snippet here of the civil war in heaven. There's another book from this period called Second Enoch, and it's not in any Bible, but it's Jewish literature from the time that gives us a little bit more detail, some more of the backstory. God is the speaker in this one. But one of the archangels here, Satan is not just an angel, but an archangel, a leader of angels, deviated. In Revelation, we're told, sought to be equal or higher than God. Together with a division, Revelation, we're told, it's one-third of the angels in heaven. Here, it's a division that were under his authority. He thought up the impossible idea that he might place his throne higher than the clouds which are above the heaven, that he might become equal to God. God speaking, I hurled him out from the height together with his angels. Now, interestingly, Jesus in his teachings has a reference to this same event, apparently. So Jesus knew about it and referenced this. Just obliquely, there's not much detail, but in Luke 10, he said to them, I watched Satan fall from heaven like a flash of lightning. Again, Revelation, Enoch, Luke, all referring to this belief within the Jewish tradition. Now, the timing is remarkable. Two things have been narrated, and we're now going to understand that they are, in fact, happening at the same time. And not only are they happening at the same time, but they are, in fact, connected. One causes the other, or contributes to causing the other. The exact moment the child is taken to heaven, Satan's kicked out of heaven. Symbolically, Satan is kicked out of heaven by the death, the resurrection, and the ascension of Christ. The death of Jesus, in other words, has cosmic significance. It's not just a historical event. It is instrumental in the defeat of evil. This view, of course, is found throughout the New Testament. Two examples. First, from Hebrews. He too, Jesus, shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil. By his death, the power of evil is broken. Colossians, a letter of Paul. having disarmed the powers and the authorities. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. That the casting out of Satan at the moment Jesus dies and goes to heaven is not just a coincidence. It's what John now turns to as he gives us more details confirming this. Verses 10 and 11. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our comrades has now been the fourth time thrown down. But they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb." And so John now makes it crystal clear. It is Christ's death on the cross that has led to the defeat of Satan. But there's another part of the story that John has not narrated. He's not quite finished here. It's the part we play. Going back to that key verse, verse 11, repeating just a little what we heard and then carrying it forward. For they have conquered him. Satan, the devil, has been conquered by the blood of the Lamb, by the death of Jesus on the cross, and by the word of their testimony. Remembering in Revelation, anytime we have the word testimony or the word witness, the Greek word is martyr, those who have died for the faith. For they did not cling to life, even in the face of death. Satan is conquered by the blood of the Lamb, the death of Jesus on the cross, and by the blood of the saints, the martyrs who die for Christ. The blood of the Lamb and the blood of those who die for the faith both have a role to play in the defeat of evil. In other words, when a person dies for the faith, their death is not in vain. They don't just die. It's not just a loss. Their death also contributes towards God's coming victory. Again, John is telling us we have a role to play in the cosmic drama and in the ultimate defeat of evil. Our suffering, even our deaths, play a role in God's victory. This is a theme that John will return to later. But God's victory in heaven now creates a problem for those of us here on earth. It's a victory on the one hand, but it's a problem on the other hand. Verse 12. Rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them. Rejoice. Satan is defeated. He's been cast down. But woe to the earth and the sea. For the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Woe to the earth, John says. At the heart of all apocalyptic literature is an attempt to explain the presence of evil and pain and suffering in the world. Why is it that evil people seem to prosper and the righteous so often seem to suffer? Why is it, God, that these things happen? The answer given in Revelation, and it's the answer that comes from apocalyptic literature, is that the pain and the persecution we experience is only part of a larger cosmic struggle between good and evil. Not only that, but our suffering is actually a good sign. It's a sign that evil has already suffered a major defeat and has been cast out of heaven. Our suffering is because Satan has been cast down and he knows his time is short. John will now map out the consequences of an enraged Satan on the earth where we are. Verses 13 and 14. So when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman, God's people, who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness. To her place where she was nourished for a time, two times, and a half time. Having been defeated in heaven, an enraged Satan now strikes back here on earth at God's people on the earth. But even in this, Satan fails. The woman is given the wings of an eagle and is able to escape. Now, John is drawing, again, as you probably know, on a well-known image from the prophet Isaiah that was turned into a song from Isaiah 40. Those who wait upon the Lord, and that's what John always says, you know, be patient, hang in there, wait. Those who wait in the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. John will repeatedly say that God will deliver soon, but in the meantime, we have to endure. In the language of Isaiah 40, we are to wait upon the Lord, for ultimately we'll be given eagle's wings. But evil has not yet given up. God's people are still in danger as Satan strikes yet again at God's people. Verse 15. From the mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with the flood, drowned her. Now, as you probably know, water in the Old Testament is an ancient symbol for chaos and evil, going back to the creation story, where God brings order out of the primordial chaos of water by creating the dry land. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep waters. And the wind from God swept over the face of the waters, bringing order out of chaos. In later Jewish tradition, the deep became a symbol for the forces of evil. We see this in Psalm 69, where the psalmist is dealing with an issue that he's being persecuted by people, but when he describes the experience of what that's like, he uses the imagery of water and of drowning. Deliver me from my enemies, O God, and from the deep waters. Do not let the flood sweep over me, or the deep swallow me, or the pit close its mouth over me. Waters, flood, drowning, the pit, all being images for suffering. Once again, Satan's attempt to destroy God's people is doomed to failure. God's creation will now come to the rescue. Verse 16. But the earth came to the help of the woman. It opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from its mouth. So just as water is a symbol for the forces of evil, earth, God's creation, is now a symbol that will come to the aid of the woman. Just as God brought forth dry land out of the waters of chaos in the creation story, so too will the dry land deliver God's people out of the waters of chaos. Now, once again, this is another part of Jewish tradition. We see it in Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's, all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. Water, symbolic of chaos and evil, but the land, the earth, is God's creation and represents God. The dragon uses the forces of water and chaos, but God's people are saved by what God created. Verse 17. Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on us, the rest of her children, on those who keep the commandments of God and those who hold the testimony of Jesus. Once again, John freely moves between Jewish imagery and Christian imagery, not seeing much difference between the two. Those who keep the commandments would remind you of Israel and Jewish people. Those who hold the testimony of Jesus, of course, you think of the Christian community. And again, John seems to envision both communities as kind of a united community. those who keep the commandments. We need to remind ourselves for John, what's important is the commandments on the first tablet, not the second tablet. We don't have any references in Revelation of John being concerned about the poor, the needy, the oppressed, social outreach, those type of concerns. Just as he doesn't focus on things like justification or sanctification, original sin or great teaching. John, he's always focused like a laser on this issue of the authentic worship of God. So for him, the commandments are these. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an idol. You shall not bow down to them and worship them. These are the great themes that he returns to again and again and again. When we put together all of the imagery and all of the statements we have in chapter 12, they give a remarkable explanation for suffering. Why do we suffer? Why are we persecuted? The answer given here, and it's the answer of apocalyptic literature, is because Satan is a loser, a four-time loser. Satan rebelled against God, but lost the battle in heaven with Michael, and of course with Jesus' death on the cross, and was there cast down. Satan then sought the life of the child, but the child was taken up to heaven. Satan is defeated again. Satan went after the woman, but the woman was given wings to escape in the desert. Satan is defeated a third time. Satan attempted to drown the woman, but the earth swallowed up the waters of chaos. Four times, Satan is defeated. Having been defeated four times, all that is left for Satan to do is to simply go after God's people here on earth. And in that, we are given an explanation for human suffering and evil. That we now suffer is not a sign of Satan's strength. It is a sign of Satan's weakness. Now, Satan is still dangerous, but Satan has been cast down four times, defeated four times. John says it repeatedly for emphasis. Evil is still there, still real, but operating in a very limited area. The end is certain, but we already know who has the real power. But evil is not quite finished. There is more to come. In the final verse of chapter 12, John sets the stage for what's going to follow in the rest of the book of Revelation. Here it is, verse 18. Then the dragon, the great Satan, the devil, took his stand on the sand of the seashore, on the beach. The dragon waits. He has one more trick up his sleeve, a power that he can recruit and he can use, a power that comes from the sea. This is symbolic, of course, the sea being symbolic of chaos. But in the first century, it is also has a very literal meaning. There is one power in John's time that controls the sea, not a sea, the sea, who also represents the forces of evil and chaos. This, of course, is the Roman Empire, which is built around a sea. We refer to it as the Mediterranean Sea. They refer to it as Mare Nostrum, our sea. So John is next going to depict a power that arises from here that will come out of the sea and inflict suffering on God's people. The dragon is last seen standing on the shore of the sea. In the very next scene, we'll see that new entity that will arise from the sea, the beast. For next week, we will turn to chapter 13. And we'll turn to the beast that arises from the sea. Until then, stay safe, and we look forward to being with you again.